Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. For Neil deGrasse Tyson, ignorance is not bliss. As host of the program Nova Science Now, he joins the rest of us in exploring different topics from when humans can walk on Mars in Captain Kirk-like suits to how smart dogs really are. Today, we'll explore a few of these scientific adventures and discuss further the new season of Nova Science Now with Neil deGrasse Tyson. Neil is an American astrophysicist. He's hosted Nova Science Now on PBS since 2006. Neil, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
You know, I mentioned that you join the rest of us in exploring these various topics because you're an astrophysicist. You're not somebody who studies how dogs think, for example.
Well, many of our segments for Nova Science Now, just in case your audience may not be familiar, you know, we all know NOVA, right? That's mm-hmm. the one-hour-long program on science that in some ways established the genre of science documentary programming, where you would interview various scientists in their labs, and you don't see a host. It's just a sort of the disembodied voice that carries you through the program. And what PBS, what WGBH in particular, the Boston affiliate of PBS, recognized was that the average age of who watched NOVA was growing by a half a year per year.
Meaning they were getting older.
Oh, getting older, that's correct.
Okay.
And so they needed some other way to deliver the science that could be more interesting to a younger audience. And they figured that if they brought on a host, that would help because we like being tour guides, basically. And instead of one subject filling the hour, you break it up into multiple segments of different topics or different angles on the same topic. And so I became the host, and I'm an astrophysicist, and many of our segments are on the universe, space travel, space propulsion, robotics, this sort of thing. But occasionally, I willingly get tossed into segments as your host of a segment where it's something completely out of my realm, like dog brains or the growing of human organs as replacement parts. And so these were segments I thoroughly enjoyed, and I learned quite a bit. And in those cases, I was like the viewer, just sort of stepping in, not knowing much at all, but having an inquisitive mind.
You know, I think I interviewed a handful of astrophysicists a few months ago, and they were a lot of fun to talk to. We had a blast. They had
fun.
How did
that happen? How do you interview a handful of astrophysicists?
There was some conference here. Don't ask me to repeat the name of the conference. It was all way over my head. And I felt like, what am I doing with these astrophysicists? How can I even talk to them? But I think you guys get a bad rap. You're much more.
I think we're really normal people.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, they started talking about the black holes and that kind of stuff and all sorts of things that I can't repeat because I simply can't remember. But they made it sound interesting and fun. And so I thought you kind of get a bad rap. And then I didn't know you were an astrophysicist when I would see you on television, but I saw you on The Daily Show with Jon Stewart. And that's where I learned that, frankly. So, you know, like I said, you kind of get a bad rap. You're more conversational than maybe people realize.
Well, I think there are many conversational scientists out there. The problem is a perennial problem is that being sociable or socialized, it does not accrue to your professional standing as a scientist.
Mm-hmm.
So if you don't happen to be sociable, or you could even be socially regressive, you can still be a great scientist and no one will hold that against you. And if you are socially active and you conduct yourself that way, by the way, in the days before Carl Sagan, it would actually subtract from you, and it even did a little
bit. You'd seem sort of fluffy then.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. People start judging, colleagues judge you differently. But that's changed, at least in astrophysics, largely because of the efforts of Carl Sagan, who carved a whole new path for science to go from the laboratory door to that of the general public.
My guest is Neil deGrasse Tyson. He is an American astrophysicist, and he has hosted Nova Science Now on PBS since 2006. If you have a question or comment for Neil, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can also go to our All Sides with Ann Fisher Facebook page and post your comment there. Neil, you mentioned that previously it didn't accrue to your role as a scientist to do what you do now, but the whole issue of science and our learnedness in science, and for a lot of people, their lack of interest in science has to be overcome somehow. You see yourself playing a part in that?
Exactly. And so that's part of the reality check on the ivory tower scientific research community. You can't just continue that way and not have, because most of the money that funds laboratory research is tax-based sourced. So you have the National Science Foundation. In the medical field, you have the National Institutes of Health. NASA is a big funder. And all these are all tax-based sources, and you are a taxpayer, I presume. Mm-hmm. And so at some point time of day, you have the right, in fact, and we have the obligation to share with you what's going on that frontier. And I think Carl Sagan did it best. He did it first in a big way. And it would only be later that the professional community would recognize the value of that activity for the stability of their own funding, for the greater good of science and society.
The space shuttle program is winding down, and there's a lot of sadness. How are you feeling about that?
I think you need to analyze why people are sad. I'm going to tell you why people are sad. They don't even know why. I'm going to tell you why.
Okay.
They're sad because there isn't another ship sitting on an adjacent launch pad that's bigger, better, more modern, that's going to take us to Mars. If such a thing existed, then you'd say, great, put it in a museum, goodbye, let's keep going. Nobody lamented the Mercury Redstone rockets that mm-hmm. took up the Mercury astronauts. No one lamented the Gemini rockets, because Gemini was on the launch pad right after the Mercury Redstones. And the Saturn V was on the launch pad ready to go to the moon right after the Geminis. And so we lament it because we don't see anything to follow it. And so there's a bit of nostalgia there. But my concern is that in space exploration, nostalgia only exists because you're not doing anything better. And if you kept doing things better, you would say, great, we had a great run, put it aside, let's keep moving.
But we're not. It feels like it's all ending.
Yeah. Well, it's we will not, after these next couple of shuttle launches, STS 134 and 135. Mm-hmm. I don't think 135 is fully funded yet, but it's ready to go. Those would be the last two missions, and for the foreseeable future. And what one of my concerns is when a president, in this particular case, Obama, when he gave a speech at Kennedy Space Center, which I attended. It was a brilliant, scintillating speech. Even if you factor out that he gives good speeches, this one was good. Even when you factor that in. Mm-hmm. So he described our future in space and that we'd visit asteroids and comets and Mars. And you look at the timetable for that, it is in the late 2020s, 2030s. It is far beyond any possible influence he can have on the flow of politics. So I've come to be quite critical of politicians who promise things outside of their political tenure, because it's hard enough to get something done within your own political control. When it's outside of your time, you could possibly be in office. And then I wonder, what kind of promise is it? The Kennedy promise, let's go to the moon before the decade is out. You got to remember, had he lived and was elected a second term, that would have happened under his watch. He fully expected that to have happened under his watch. Apollo 1 had the launch pad fire, which delayed things 24 months. And so, yes, we landed July 1969. He would have been out of office January 1969. But without the Apollo 1 fire, we would have been on the moon in 1968, easily. And so he projected an activity in the future that would have happened under his own watch. And I think that was brilliant. Had he said, let's do it sometime before the century is out, I don't think we would have ever left Earth's surface.
How much do you think the difference we feel about the space program, such as it is and has been for the last 20 or so years, is a reflection of, I don't know, it's very different from when you and I think, I'm not quite sure how old you are, but when I was growing up, we had space sticks and Tang, and they made a big, hairy deal out of that kind of stuff. There was a lot of stuff out there, and kids kind of glommed onto it. There doesn't seem to be that much, you know, they have the space camps and things like that, but not very many kids actually get to go to that kind of stuff.
Yeah, our journeys into space created a state of mind of the nation, a kind of zeitgeist where the future was in reach and people were empowered. empowered to dream about what that future would be like. You remember these? You don't have to be that old. Maybe above 40, and you would remember weekly. You wouldn't have to go more than a week before you would see an article in a magazine or a newspaper that talked about the home of tomorrow, the cars of tomorrow, food of tomorrow.
Well, 21st century, that old program, remember?
Exactly. I remember that. Yeah. Thanks for reminding me. That's right. And so the whole concept of thinking about tomorrow, I am convinced, was empowered, was emboldened and enabled by the fact that NASA was on a major frontier of mind and a body of soul of technology. And without it, where do you turn? People will still dream up other stuff, but it won't be about the future. And I think we are starved for that kind of societal, cultural imperative that I think many of us took for granted in the 1960s and 70s.
My guest is Neil deGrasse Tyson. He is host of Nova Science Now. He's also an American astrophysicist. If you'd like to speak with Neil, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. We're going to take a break right now. When we return, we'll continue our conversation with Neil and take your calls and emails. This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News.
This is 89.7 NPR News. Discover more about All Sides with Ann Fisher online at wosu.org/allsides. You can listen to new and archived shows from all the guests and topics. You can also find All Sides on Facebook and Twitter. Discover more about WOSU and All Sides with Ann Fisher at wosu.org/allsides. And it's currently 62 degrees in downtown Columbus. There is a slight chance, a very slight chance of showers today, and then cloudy skies and a high near 70 degrees. A few clouds tonight, a low of 55, and then clearing out for the weekend, sunshine for Saturday, and a high of 79, sunny on Sunday, and a high of 85 degrees. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on 89.7 NPR News. Thanks for joining us.
Welcome back to All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. Our guest this hour, Neil deGrasse Tyson, host of Nova Science Now on PBS since 2006, and also an American astrophysicist. If you have a question or comment for Neil, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. We'll be checking out some cuts from some of the shows coming up later. If you have a favorite show you'd like to share with Neil and tell him about, give us a call, 614-292-8513. And Edward from Mount Gilead, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Good morning, Ann. Good morning, Dr. Tyson.
Good morning.
I'm a 70-year-old grandfather of nine, and some of my grandchildren. I'm very fascinated with science. I've been a watcher of NOVA since the beginning, and when Dr. Tyson came on the scene, I thought, this guy is the best thing to happen to science on television since Carl Sagan. But I want to ask Dr. Tyson this question. If the funding for public broadcasting is cut off, this country needs scientists and engineers, and he does such a great job of getting kids interested in science, making it fun and exciting, showing that scientists and engineers have fun and they're just like ordinary folks. He shows experiments. You know, what's going to happen to our children if they're not exposed to that sort of an incentive to get into the sciences and engineering? Dr. Tyson probably gets around all over the country and talks to people who are at the stations and can give him, firsthand experience of how they've been inspired by his programming. So I'll take the answer off the air. Thank you very much, Dr. Tyson.
Thank you, Edward.
And Ann, bye-bye.
Mm-hmm.
Well, thanks for that question. That's a very important line of inquiry, particularly now. And if you read the paper, of course, you know that the funding for the Corporation for Public Broadcasting is sort of thrown into debate in Congress. And I was actually quite pleased to learn that the fraction of a typical station's total funding traceable to the Corporation for Public Broadcasting is relatively small, and that most of that funding comes from viewers like you. The iconic phrase that you get on a PBS station.
Kind of rolls off the tongue, doesn't it?
And so while any cut monies is bad, if those monies are cut, it is not the death knell for the entire system. It would be a greater struggle than what people already go through. One of my great concerns is how casually people think about the importance of science in society. Science is so ubiquitous, and it's so transparent, I guess. The fact that you just pull out your cell phone and while you're walking down the street, call someone else who's walking down the street 20 states away, we don't pause and reflect on how remarkable that is often enough. And I think if we did, then any possible way that you could excite interest in a generation of people becoming a scientist would be pumped with so much money. It would transform how we live and how we spend money as a nation. And so I think, yes, the awareness of the value of science to our culture needs as many outlets as possible. What PBS is fighting now is the fact, the simple fact, profound fact, actually, that there are other stations in the pantheon of cable that produce documentary programming. There was a day when PBS was essentially the only documentary show network on television, and that's not the case now. So PBS is struggling to maintain an identity, and that's what's being debated. By the way, this won't be the first year that was debated. This has been going on for at least half a decade from my read of the press. And so it may just be a sort of scare tactic just to spook PBS into sort of rethinking its programming lineup. In any case, especially these days, one needs to take threats to funding seriously. And I spent a big part of my professional career trying to convince people of the value of science in their lives, not only because it's cool, but because it is fundamental to economic growth. We've known since the Industrial Revolution that innovations in science and technology are the foundations of tomorrow's economies. And if you don't embrace that fact, you just fade. And I see America fading right now as the rest of the world has figured this out and is rising past us economically. We think of them as just economic giants, but if you park the curtains and you look down in, you see that there's an entire science technology infrastructure that is empowering the economic strength.
And so much of the innovation and the ideas that propelled the country forward didn't come from necessarily the obvious sources. They didn't necessarily come from, you know, the ivory towers. They came from really smart people.
Yeah, that's right. Exactly. And the smart people can show up anytime, any place. And you want to make sure that such people have the opportunity to exhibit those smarts and exhibit that creativity, mm-hmm. and especially the innovations necessary to create whole new economies, which is what's been going on, and that's what's transformed the world. Well, you don't buy buggy whips anymore. You can't find them in the phone book, but they're entire sections on computers and on mm-hmm. the IT industry, something that essentially didn't exist 20 years ago, not in the level, well, I guess now 25 years ago. Mm-hmm. And so and these are innovative people who think this stuff up, who happen to have been if you look at Bill Gates and Steve mm-hmm. Jobs and folks of that stratum of age and of innovation, they were 10, 11, 12, 13, 14 when we were landing on the moon. That's just the right age to be completely taken by the future and by how you might transform it yourself.
Juan from Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I am a postdoctoral fellow at the Mathematical Biosciences Institute based on Ohio State University. And I might be slightly biased towards the biosciences, but I was wondering, it seems to me that biosciences are the new frontier. We're not looking into the outer space right now. We're looking into our bodies and this huge universe, which we really do not understand. One single cell in the tiniest structure at the cell, we don't know what's going on there, and there are many things we don't know. So it seems like a lot of funding, interest, and the imagination is being captured by biosciences. Would you think that this is an accurate statement?
Yeah, so thanks for that comment. And so first, yes, biosciences, especially neurosciences, at least if I were to rank them in terms of where there's the greatest ignorance and promise for discovery, the human mind remains one of the most intractable organs of the body, and biology in general, for sure. But consider, first of all, that the budget for the National Institutes of Health exceeds that of NASA by $10 billion. Exceeds it by $10 billion. So it's not as though you're not getting the funding. You're definitely getting the funding. So one should not think of that's the new frontier and not something else. They're all frontiers. That's point one. Point two, every single machine you've ever brought into the service of your trade, especially in the medical professions, is based on some principle of physics discovered by a physicist who had no particular interest in medicine. The application came about through medical technologists and engineers, of course, but the physical principles are traceable to the frontier of physics at a generation earlier than when it became a practical device. So I submit that when you want to advance a culture and you want to do so in a meaningful way, the cross-pollination of fields becomes the most significant, has the greatest potential for revolutionary advances in any one of the fields that are being cross-pollinated. And if you only put the money in one field and try to solve a problem that you cite without looking to other fields that could have crossover value, then you put Band-Aids on problems, or you might find a solution that works a little bit, you know, for today, but maybe not for tomorrow. It's the truly profound solutions to problems that come about when you cross-pollinate. And NASA, since the mid-1990s, in its search for life in the universe, has as its frontier the need to have the best biologists, the best chemists, the best planetary geologists, the best astrophysicists, the best aerospace engineers, which they've always needed, of course. But nowadays, all the fields... Excuse me.
Mm-hmm.
Another phone ringing. So all of the frontiers are being represented on the frontier of in the NASA's current portfolio, and that's why I see NASA as, yes, we're exploring space, but it's stimulating an entire generation of people to go into all of the STEM fields: the science, technology, engineering, and math.
Juan?
I agree with what you're saying. This is a multidimensional problem, what we have with the advance of science and in our society. It seems to me that new generations are less inclined to pursue science as a career. Just look at the number of majors in universities, and by far the largest amount goes into administration, business, mm-hmm. Physical education, etc. And look also at the population, at the demographics of graduate schools in STEM, science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. More than half are foreigner. And that tells you something about where our society is going. So thank you so much for giving me the opportunity to talk, and thank you for your opinion.
Sure. And a quick comment about the foreign population in the STEM fields and graduate studies. That's been the case since the 1980s. And so that was never a problem, even if you're the most, the most ardent of patriots. It's never been a problem because historically those folks who are foreign nationals would get their advanced degrees and stay.
Mm-hmm.
And so they would bring their creativity to the American enterprise. What I see now happening is that you get the foreign nationals, they come, and then they go back to their home country, be it Singapore or India or China, because that's where the opportunities are. And so then it becomes a kind of a brain drain compared with what it was 20, 30 years ago.
Thank you, Juan. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. I want to listen to one of the programs right now. A little cut from that. And this one's about replacing body parts. Organs might be as difficult to come by in the future. And On a Nova Science Now special, Doris Taylor from the University of Minnesota commented on the future of organ scaffolding.
I absolutely see a day where you'll walk into a manufacturing facility somewhere, and there will be jars of kidneys, and jars of livers, and jars of lungs, whatever it is you need.
Okay, that sounds kind of creepy when you just cut it out like that. But
what I mean, it just means creepy.
You know, but what I was interested in with that program is the way you introduce it in terms of science fiction, in terms of like that movie The Island, and there's others about cloning humans to be used for nefarious purposes, to be used for their bodies. There was just another movie out, I think, Never Let Me Go, was another science fiction movie. But it's like that relationship between science fiction and science. And some people look down on science fiction and think it's kind of, you know, not worthy of them. What do you think about science fiction and what it supposes?
I think science fiction is great. At its best, it tells stories of the culture in which you live, but in a context that allows them to go places you might not otherwise be able to go in your storytelling. And the whole Star Trek series, for example, if you look at it, you say, oh, it's just meeting aliens around, but every single episode, the original Star Trek and those that followed, every single episode was some sociocultural element, but played out on an alien landscape. And so it's ways for storytellers to embed a issues of modern times in a fantastic landscape that that could make the story a little more palatable to people that would otherwise discount it as being propaganda, for example. If you're trying to create social change and you just hit someone over the head with it, they say, no, I'm not going to do it. You portray it with the relationship between aliens and humans. This is what the theme of X-Men is about. These are human beings with different talents, and there are laws that prevent them from holding office. And so they force you to sort of look back on your own culture in ways that traditional storytelling might not be able to. I'll add to that that science fiction also, at its best, will scare the living daylights out of you with science gone bad. Look at Jurassic Park. Look at the Andromeda Strain. And I don't have a problem with that. It's all fiction. What it does do, it makes my job a little harder when you tell people about new science frontiers, because people tend to fear what they don't understand. And it's understandable that you would fear what you don't understand. So my goal is not to tell you don't be afraid. My goal is to get you to learn enough about it so that you will know why you shouldn't be afraid. And this whole thing about cloning yourself so that you can have spare parts as organs, it's absurd to think that we would do that, because society already has within it what are essentially clones. That's what twins are, okay? We have twins, all right? They already exist, all right? So does one of them take control over the other and harvest their body parts? Do we actually do that? No. So why do you think we would do it if you managed to do it in the lab? I mean, just pause for a minute and reflect on what's already going on in society. So getting back to the Nova Science Now piece, you're not actually cloning yourself to get the organs that would be on shelves in the supermarket, but you would actually grow these organs using your own cells on an architecture of, for example, pig organs. Pigs, a large enough hog, their organs are approximately the same size as those of humans, and so you get the scaffolding of their organs. It's what's left over when you strip it of all of its sort of biological cells, and then you get the scaffold of what the heart is, of what the kidney is, of what the lung is, and then you grow your cells onto that scaffold, and then it becomes your organ, and it becomes a non-rejectable organ because it's your own body cells. That's the big problem with organ transplants, is the ability to not reject a donor organ. So That's an interesting future. And then if that's the future that comes, then there's no need to even think about clones for this purpose. Mm-hmm. That would render moot any science fiction story that wanted to scare you that way.
614-292-8513. And Anne from Berea, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for taking my call. I was interested in Dr. Tyson's take on the efforts by entrepreneurs like Elon Musk and Richard Branson to move to a more commercially based space transportation system, and whether he thinks that that will act as an inspiration to young people to want to go into fields like aerospace engineering.
Yeah, thanks. That's a great question. And first, I'm all for commercialization of space. Keep in mind, however, that the commercialization of space will essentially never involve the frontier, because there is no capital market valuation of the frontier. So the only way you can advance a frontier of that kind is by government money. The only known way is by government. So the government advances the frontier, makes it routine, then hands over all the patents and all the thing back to those who invented it, and then they create a marketplace for what had happened. So when we think of commercial space, we're thinking of entrepreneurs and other sort of corporate entities giving access to Earth orbit. This is a place we've been. It's no longer a frontier for NASA. It doesn't mean it's not hard to accomplish it. It's just not a frontier. And so you do it. It's relatively routine. You hand it over and put getting NASA back doing what it does best, which is advancing a frontier.
Thank you, Anne.
Thank you.
Yep, take care.
Okay.
We have an email from Sharon. She says, my son is studying geophysics in Colorado, but is gaining a great interest in astrophysics and is interested in tilting his studies in that direction. What do you recommend he do for internships the next few summers, considering the space program is coming to an end?
Oh, yeah. So the National Science Foundation has a program called the REU is the abbreviation, the Research Experience for Undergraduates. He's an undergraduate, is that right?
Yeah, it sounds like it, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So you just look up REU, a Research Experience for Undergraduates, on the NSF website. And these are centers across the country housed at universities where there are people doing active astrophysics research. And you get to participate in research programs. By the way, astrophysics is not just NASA. It's black holes, it's quasars, it's Big Bang, it's whether Pluto's a planet or not. I mean, there's the rest of the universe beyond NASA's access to space that is represented in astrophysics. And so, and if he's interested in the aerospace aspect of astrophysics, there will always be satellites that get launched. Most of what happens at the Jet Propulsion Labs in Pasadena, California, which is a joint facility between Caltech and NASA, most of what goes on there is building satellites. You got engineers and astrophysicists and geologists, by the way, who are active in designing rovers, for example, to roll around on Mars. Over on the West Coast, on the East Coast, you have the Goddard Space Flight Center, which is in Maryland, and they're responsible for the Hubble telescope and a whole other sort of suite of unmanned space probes. And so there's still plenty to do, whether or not NASA is getting you to low Earth orbit.
We have to take another break. My guest is Neil deGrasse Tyson. He's the host for Nova Science Now. He's also an astrophysicist. Stick with us. We have more to come when we return on All Sides on 89.7 NPR News.
Previously on Car Talk.
You don't think that that's going to hurt his feelings?
Who cares?
Men don't have any feelings.
Oh, what a relief. That's a burden off my shoulders.
You know, I mean, would you object to his going away by himself on these things?
Oh, no, not at all.
How about his secretary?
Don't miss the fun this week.
Join us for Car Talk.
Car Talk tomorrow at noon on 89.7 NPR News. Thanks for joining us for All Sides with Ann Fisher today. In 20 minutes at 11 o'clock, All Sides Weekend begins with a discussion of enjoying summer activities around Ohio with a travel panel. Join us for All Sides Weekend beginning at 11, right here on 89.7 NPR News. And Sunday night on WOSU-TV, watch an evening that has become an American tradition. Live from the U.S. Capitol, it's the National Memorial Day Concert, honoring the service and sacrifice of our men and women in uniform. Watch Sunday night at 8 on WOSU-TV. 63 degrees with cloudy skies in downtown Columbus, cloudy skies throughout the day and a high near 70. Clouds tonight, a low of 55. Looks like a beautiful three-day weekend ahead, mostly sunny for Saturday, a high of 79. Sunshine for Sunday and a high of 87. And more sunshine on Memorial Day with a high near 90. This is 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. My guest is Neil deGrasse Tyson. He's the host of Nova Science Now. If you have a question or comment for him, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We have an email from Matthew. He says, I'm a computer science student at Ohio State. I'm just curious about your guest's thoughts about our media covering scientific discoveries where the actual science behind the discoveries is not peer-reviewed and is quite controversial among the scientific community. Such examples being the arsenic-based life form NASA presented a while back and the recent quote-unquote discovery of alien life on meteorites. What do you say?
Yeah, that's a tricky question because there's not just a clean answer. So let me try to give an efficient reply. There are certain journals that are more reputable than others, and they're reputable because of the scrutiny that they give to proposed papers that seek to be published within them. The scrutiny comes about from the number of reviewers, the reputation of the reviewers, the reputation of previous papers that they publish, etc. So if you manage to get a paper peer-reviewed into this handful of respected journals, then the media has every right to jump all over it and report on it and make headlines and the like. If your paper ends up in a lesser journal, and if you're in your field, you know what the respected journals are and what the lesser journals are, then even if it is peer-reviewed, if it's ended up in a lesser journal because it did not make it into a premier journal, then you start have to raise your eyebrow and say, well, why didn't it get into the mainstream journal? What is it about the result? Is it controversial because it's the methods are flawed, or is it an idea that's just not being accepted by mainstream? So you have to sort of make another judgment. This is what an experienced journalist does. When you're not an experienced journalist and you just report on anything you see or hear, that's where the maelstrom takes over, and then the public has no idea what to believe and what not because it's reported in the press, and the press has some authority to it because they presumably vetted it. So this recent discovery of life in a meteorite was not accepted at a mainstream journal and was later published in a lesser journal, a journal that has less respect in the field in which he's publishing. And as a result, all the people who would have resisted its publication in the mainstream journal came out of the woodwork and commented on it in blogs and in the like, and ultimately NASA distanced itself from it. That story, by the way, was originally broken in the media by Fox News. So Fox did not distinguish that it was in a lesser journal compared with a mainstream journal. So it's not just a sort of an A or B, right? There's a continuum here of how you need to think about the media, and we need better trained journalists to make this judgment themselves. So that's what it comes down to. By the way, even if the journalists do it right and chase the results that are in mainstream journals, there's still the problem where most things that are published, even in mainstream journals, will end up being shown to be wrong. Getting into a journal, the prerequisite is not that you're right, but that your methods are sound and that you're using the best available data and methods and tactics. If it's later shown to be wrong, that's not you're not to blame for that. And science is this bloody, ratty frontier as you're advancing it forward. No doubt about it. Even when everything works well, the journalist would report it as truth rather than as some experiment that may be true. And that I have a problem with that as well, because they report, cholesterol's good, no, cholesterol's bad, or, you know, ice cream is good, no, jogging is bad. And,
mm-hmm.
and they will report on a single study without waiting for the consensus to emerge, which is where scientific truths are found, in the consensus of researchers, not in some single experiment that somebody does that happened to be different from the rest of the results.
Here's an email from Tom in Columbus. He says, I'd like to let Dr. Tyson know that this season of Nova was one of the best ever. I'd like to ask Dr. Tyson if in the episode with the Avatar, if Jason was actually carrying on a conversation with his Avatar or if he had programmed its responses.
No, those are actual conversations. So there were, in that particular case, there's a... you program everything that is you into an avatar, and then you could have a conversation with yourself. And there was a mixture of sort of pre-programmed phrases, but a phrase only has a sort of a fragment of a meaning, and you combine multiple fragments of meanings into new meanings. And so, yes, there is a cognitive element going on there. What they did not show, which you surely could have done, was asked it a question that could just completely stump it. Like, the famous version of this is, you know, time flies like an arrow, right? We all know what that means. But a formally identical sentence to that is, fruit flies like a banana. Those two sentences are structurally identical, yet they have completely different interpretations, right? And so, in the first case, is there such a kind of fly called a time fly? Right, because there's a fruit fly, why wouldn't there be a time fly? And do these flies, you know, they like arrows? Do they like riding along arrows? If you're a computer and you don't have the context of life experience, you wouldn't necessarily know how to distinguish those two sentences from each other. You'd be prone to interpret them the same way. And so you could find sentences that could completely make smoke come out of the ears of a computer still. And the real task will be to have a computer that understands context. This was the big challenge with the computer on Jeopardy.
Right.
Does the computer understand? Because it's not just a mathematical calculation. There's culture involved in most of the questions that get asked. That was, what's the computer's name again?
I want to say Walter. Watkins.
Walter. Watson.
Something with a W. Okay. Watkins. Yeah.
Watson. Named for the Watson Center, Research Center in Westchester. And one of the founders of IBM, his last name is Watson. So that's where the greatest challenges are. Can a computer be like humans, because humans have life experience that inform the interpretation of every word that you hear that comes out of a person's mouth? So it was doing a combination of both, but there's still a long way to go.
Tom, in that same email, went on to say that another great program was the dog that could recognize 1,000 different toys and keep up the great work. And we have a cut from that, so let's listen.
A dog is like a soldier. They're like a soldier of science. They show up and they're like, yes, sir, I'm here to play. Let's do this game. Let's find out how my mind works. You know, is that a biscuit? Okay, I'm whatever you need.
That's Brian Hare. He's a primate researcher talking about the intelligence of dogs. And did you learn anything from that program, Neil?
I had no idea. You know, I've been around dogs most of my life. I used to walk dogs, which you can do in a big city, mm-hmm. and make money for having done so. And I paid for my first telescope doing that when I was in middle school. And so I have a long – by the way, that was the glory days of dog walking where you didn't have to clean up after. I don't forget for a minute that when I see dog walkers today with a satchel full of baggies sticking out of their pocket.
Uh-huh.
It's like, man. I had it good back in my day. So I thought a lot about how dogs think and what kind of consciousness they hold. And I'd always imagined that they were smarter than we ever gave them credit for. And this story on this dog, Chaser, it's a version of a sheepdog that it knows the names of 1,000 toys. I mean, period. Now, we didn't test it on all 1,000. I took the mound of 1,000 toys, reached in at random, pulled out 10, then told him to find each of those 10, and found them flawlessly. I threw in actually a toy. It was a little stuffed animal, a stuffed likeness of Darwin, who he's never seen, does not know what Darwin looks like, does not know that it's called Darwin. I threw it back there with the 10, And about a third of the way through, there were about 7 toys left, I said, bring me Darwin. Never heard of Darwin, doesn't know what Darwin looks like. Goes around there, comes, took him twice as long, but brought back Darwin. It inferred that the toy it did not know the name of must have been what I was asking it to bring. And that was Darwin. So that was that level of inference was like, whoa. So maybe these dogs are doing calculus in their sleep or something. I don't know.
Well, maybe all those movies, you know, cats and dogs,
where they're actually in charge, right? I saw all those movies. They're scary, actually.
614.
But my favorite line was, one dog says to the other, who do you think is actually in charge, you know? Do we clean up their poop? No, they're cleaning up ours.
Exactly.
We're the ones in charge.
Got it all worked out. 614-292-8513. And Jason from Columbus, you're on the air with Neil deGrasse Tyson. Welcome to the show.
Hey, thank you very much. Mm-hmm. I have a childhood question. I believe we know that the universe is expanding through the Doppler effect on light. And I don't know if I'm remembering that correctly from high school days. But kind of a question I've always wondered in my mind is, if we know the universe is expanding, which is, you know, popularly agreed upon, what's it expanding into? What's the vastness that it's able to keep moving into? And is that empty, or does that have a whole other universe that's expanding into that, you know, realm? You know,
I can answer that quite simply. We have no idea. Next question.
There you go.
It's not true to say that we have no idea. We have no evidence to describe anything that's going on outside of our expanding universe. And so let's start there. We have some ideas about what could be going on. Some of them are quite fertile and based on very successful theories of the universe that we currently have. And they would include discussions of a multiverse where we're expanding in embedded in a higher dimensionality of many universes, each of them expanding and contracting, some expanding forever. We happen to be in one that's expanding forever. And so there's a higher dimensional space in which this is happening. And so it'd be like being embedded in a sheet of paper, let's say the two dimensions of a sheet of paper, and then the paper expands, and you say to yourself, what are we expanding into? And any three-dimensional person looking down on the paper say, look, you don't occupy any space at all. And you think your whole world is just these two dimensions, and I'd look at the full three-dimensionality of what's around it. So any higher dimensional entity looking at us would see us constricted to our measly three dimensions, and here we are posing questions, what are we expanding into? And they would chuckle at our inability to imagine the higher dimensions that they all take for granted. So there's conversation about what could be outside of our universe, but none of it is anchored in data, so it's just fun chatter over beer at this stage.
Great. Well, thank you very much.
Sure.
Thanks, Jason. Let's see, 614. Well, we don't have much time, but I want to get to a few more calls. Roland from Cincinnati, welcome to the show.
Hello.
Hi.
How are you? Hello,
good.
Dr. Tyson. How are you? I enjoy.
Hello, doing well, thanks.
You know what? I was reading an article in Popular Mechanics this month,
mm-hmm.
and I run across an article on a X-37B unmanned spacecraft, and I'm wondering if that platform is going to replace our shuttle.
The program?
No, that's a different space architecture. And, oh, by the way, one of the great future possibilities is that we separate human beings from cargo. The space shuttle, we're human beings going up with cargo. So if you sort of stereotype that, you would say, well, these are just high-paid bus drivers, right? And you don't, if you're launching cargo, the ship doesn't have to be as safe as if you're launching people. Meanwhile, we had what's called man-rated vehicles that were carrying cargo. And so any future space architecture is going to have unmanned launch vehicles that will be carrying cargo, pre-positioning it either in orbit or on the moon or on Mars. And then you send people there later, and you got to hope you can land at the right spot to exploit the fact that the cargo is already there in place. That's what you do when you drive across the country. You exploit the fact that there's a quick mart halfway there where you can get food and fuel and this sort of thing. You're not bringing all the food and all the fuel that you need to make that trip.
You know, they've said that the Russians have actually a more efficient system of transport, which is
Their space capsule, the Soyuz, is one of the most reliable space vehicles ever designed. But it just wasn't large enough to bring payload sufficient to build the space station.
Okay.
So they didn't have architecture to build the space station. That's what the shuttle and the huge payload bay, which deployed the shuttle segments as well as the Hubble telescope and many other important big hunks of hardware that we now all just take for granted for being in orbit. The Russians could not have accomplished that.
Okay, Roland, thanks for your call. And Bob from Gahanna, you're on the air. You're our last caller. We are running out of time, and welcome to the show.
Well, thank you. I love your show, and I watch all the time.
Thank you.
I guess this is, as a guy who don't, I watch your show, and I see things about, like, the black hole and novas, and they got all this proof, and they show a whole big blackboard full of math and say, look, we proved it. and I just wonder how much of it is theory. Like, say, a black hole, for example, is that true for sure, absolutely, or is that a theory?
Yeah, so what matters is where is their consensus? There is consensus among astrophysicists that black holes exist because we see their paw print on their environment. We see what they do to stars. We see what they do to matter falling in, and matter escaping from it. So there's a black hole there, and we're done. We're done with that. And that just because there are equations that describe it doesn't mean that it's just hypothesis. So what matters are the data, and we have the data that match the hypothesis, and so you're done. Now you're on to the next question. We want to know what was around, for example, at the Big Bang. We have our equations. We don't have the data yet at the Big Bang. Right, or before the Big Bang. And so the frontier will always not have enough data to be sure. That's the definition of the frontier.
Okay.
So other things, and by the way, it's my responsibility to you to distinguish those two cases. One of my colleagues and partner in crime as a public scientist, Michio Kaku, I've complained to him directly that sometimes he blurs the boundary between what is established physics and what is sort of out there. Maybe it'll happen one day, maybe not. And so I hit him over the head every time I hear him not making that distinction. But at its best, we would distinguish that as educators. And black hole is not one of those that for which there is uncertainty.
Neil deGrasse Tyson, I want to thank you for joining us today.
Well, I'd be happy to be on. I'm ready to, delighted to speak to your Ohio listeners.
That is Neil deGrasse Tyson. He is host of Nova Science Now on PBS. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News.